Welcome, members and guests, to the November 15th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome to our KLCC listeners and to our TV audiences on Community Television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Marty Wilde, the City Club President. Today's sponsors are Helios Resource Network, promoting community livability by empowering local groups and businesses working towards sustainability, 91.9 KRVM, and Marilyn Milne Public Relations Services. A special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We want to extend our thanks to the Willamette Valley Company, host of this week's visit by the teachers taking the City Club Lane Workforce Partnership course about employment and the economy in Lane County. We are a member-supported organization. If you're not already a member, please consider a tax-deductible virtual or City Club membership, sponsorship, or donation. And we have a new gold sponsor, Sacred Earth Botanicals. And now here's our program coordinator, John DeWinter, to introduce the topic and our speakers.
That's wholly unexpected. Our program today is titled Managing ONC Forest Lands, an Industry and County Perspective. Our speakers are Kathy Jones of the Seneca Companies and Doug Robertson, a Douglas County Commissioner and the President of the Association of ONC Counties. This is the first of two programs focusing on the management of ONC forest lands. Our second, which will be on Friday, December 13th, will feature Ernie Niemi of Natural Forest Resources Economics and John Kober of the Pacific Rivers Council. They will give us a conservationist or environmentalist perspective on this issue. According to the 1937 Oregon and California Lands Act, which is still in effect, all ONC timberlands are to be managed for permanent forest production consistent with sustained yield, to provide permanent source of timber supply, protecting watersheds, regulating stream flow, and contributing to the economic stability of local communities and industries, and providing recreational facilities. Let me repeat those phrases. Permanent forest production, consistent with sustained yield, permanent source of timber supply, protecting watersheds, regulating stream flow, contributing to the economic stability of communities and industries, and providing recreational facilities. What each of these phrases means and how much weight should be given to the interest each phrase represents depends a lot upon the perspective of who is answering these questions. It should surprise no one when I say that we're not going to resolve these questions with the program today and the program next month. We, however, do hope that these programs will give us a better appreciation of different perspectives, an understanding that one person may hold and value more than one perspective at the same time, and a realization that we are all part of one community that, at least in time, ought to be able to resolve these questions. Kathy Jones is one of three daughters of Aaron Jones, the founder of the Seneca Group of Companies. She is a co-owner and a member of the board of directors of the Seneca Group. She is in as good a position as anyone to give us an industry perspective on how ONC forest lands should be managed. The Seneca Group owns and manages its own forest lands. It manufactures lumber at its sawmills in Eugene and Notai, and it produces power and thermal energy from wood biomass at its cogeneration facility in Eugene. Doug Robertson has served as a Douglas County Commissioner since 1980. As such, he currently is the longest-serving county commissioner in Oregon. Besides being the president of the Association of ONC Counties, he is a vice president of the board of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition. As one who has spent the last 33 years working to maintain and improve services for his county's citizens, and seeing the revenues from ONC lands that support those services diminish, he, as well as anyone, can give us a perspective of ONC counties on how those lands should be managed. Please welcome Kathy and Doug.
John, thank you very much, and thank all of you for the opportunity to be here with you and talk a little bit about the subject that has been introduced. We could talk a long time about the history of the ONC lands, why they are so unique, why they are so different from national forests, but we don't have very much time. So what I'm going to try to do this afternoon is identify some points in time that will hopefully bring into perspective the unique nature of these lands, how they came into being, why they are of such interest today for all of us. Everybody in this room will ultimately be affected by the decisions that are being considered in Congress today about the management of this land base. So let's very quickly go through a little bit of history so we have some foundation about why these lands are different and unique. In 1868, the federal government recognized the need to populate the Pacific Northwest in what was had been the Oregon Territory. This is 3 years after the Civil War. And they were very interested in getting people, settlers, out into this area because the British, the Russians, the Mexican government was looking very covetously at the resources in the Pacific Northwest, the minerals, the timber, the fur trade, and so on. The United States government wanted to get people out here and settled in these areas to start their own personal enterprises, so they had standing and a reason to protect this area. The best way to do that in those days was to make land available at very reasonable prices so people would move, and that coupled with transportation was a method in those days of the government encouraging settlement in a certain area. So in 1868, the federal government granted almost 4 million acres to the ONC Railroad Company to build the missing link of rail between Portland and Ashland, thus connecting the existing rail between San Francisco and Seattle. And that would encourage the settlement that the government was interested in, as well as being able to move military personnel and materiel north and south. The construction started on the railroad in 1869, and that in and of itself is a fascinating history, which perhaps for another day. It went through many machinations. Finally, in 1887, the final spike in the rail was driven in Ashland, and the rail was completed. At that time, the surviving company was no longer the ONC Railroad Company. It was the Southern Pacific Railroad. And upon completion of the rail, the Southern Pacific announced, and let me back up just a little bit. When the federal government granted the 4 million acres to the ONC Railroad Company, it was with three conditions. And the conditions of the grant were these. The railroad company could sell land. In fact, they were encouraged to sell land. But they could sell it only to actual settlers for no more than $2.50 an acre, and in blocks no larger than 160 acres. And they encouraged the sale because the railroad then could underwrite the cost of building the rail line and also encourage the settlement. Well, within a very short period of time, the railroad company had violated all three of the agreements, and that led to an interesting part of some of the history. But in 1887, it was completed, and upon completion, the Southern Pacific announced that it was going to keep the unsold ONC grant lands for their own private corporate timber supply. And it was about 2.5 million acres. Well, the state of Oregon and other entities and individuals rebelled at that and said, not only have you violated the original tenets of the grant, but now you're going to keep this land that should be in private ownership. That's not acceptable. So they sued them. And the lawsuit went back and forth and so on, finally ended up in 1915 in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court agreed with the plaintiffs that the railroad company had indeed violated the grant requirements. And instead of proposing a solution, simply turned to Congress and said, fix it. Well, in 1916, Congress made the first attempt to fix the issue of the ONC lands, and a very important decision. The Chamberlain-Ferris Act, sponsored by George Chamberlain, senator from Oregon, and Scott Ferris, a senator from Oklahoma, who was chairman of the Public Lands Committee in the Senate at that time, came together with the Chamberlain-Ferris Act, which basically said, we're going to revest or take the unsold lands, the 2.5 million acres, back from the railroad into federal ownership, with the understanding that we're going to sell the timber and eventually sell the land back to private parties. The intention still was for that land to be in private ownership. Well, that didn't work. It didn't work because there wasn't much demand for timber property in those days. People were interested in agriculture. They were interested in the valley, in grazing and livestock and so on. So they didn't sell any land. There was another attempt in 1926 to do the same thing with the same result. Finally, in 1937, Charles McNary and his colleagues came together and passed the 1937 ONC Act, which is in, as John remarked, is still in force today. And the 1937 Act said several things, some of which John has read, but also in terms of recognizing the difficulty that the counties were having. Remember, when land is in federal ownership, it can't be taxed, can't be developed, can't be something that contributes to, in those days, the economic benefits of the counties. So the federal government made a decision that we're not going to pay taxes. The federal government doesn't do that. What we will do instead is that when timber is sold on those lands, we will share those receipts with the counties, which evolved into a 50-50 share. When timber was sold, the counties received half of those receipts. The other half went to the federal government for management. That worked very well up until 1990. And we all know what happened in 1990. That was when the northern spotted owl was listed as an endangered species. It was followed by the Dwyer decision, Judge Dwyer out of Seattle court, and that eventuated into the Northwest Forest Plan, which was a reduction in the amount of timber being sold not only on ONC lands but also national forests by almost 90%. And the receipts that the counties had been depending on and living on also declined by almost 90%. From that point until today, actually, counties have been relying on the Secure Rural Schools Act, county safety net payments. It's known by a variety of things, but basically it is money out of the federal treasury given to counties that are affected by the decisions of the court, the Northern Spotted Owl decision and so on, to maintain basic services. The status quo that we have been dealing with ever since the listing of the owl has really not been beneficial to anybody. The owl is in decline. Many feel on the road to extinction. The health of the forest itself is declining. The economic stability of rural counties and communities continues to spiral down. The federal government loses tens of millions of dollars every year in managing these lands. So the status quo is not acceptable. And about 2.5 years ago, the board of the ONC Board of Commissioners got together and realized that if we were going to move ahead with anything, we had to change the status quo. And that meant adopting a new direction for the management of the ONC lands. We recognized that from our view, I'm a county commissioner. My number one job is to keep the doors to the courthouse open and keep services to the public at acceptable levels. Am I concerned about clean water and the environment? Of course I am, as are my colleagues. The conservation community, Oregon Wild, Cascadia Wild, those folks, are they concerned about healthy communities and law enforcement? Of course they are. But their number one issue is protection of the environment. The industry, Aaron Jones, Alan Ford, Rob Furris, those folks, are they concerned about communities and clean water? Of course. But their number one issue is making sure the viability of their enterprise remains healthy. So if you picture this issue of forest management as a piece of fabric, you've got the counties, we're pulling on ours. This is a county, these lands are for counties. The environmental community is saying, wait a minute, there are environmental interests here that have to be addressed. The industry is saying, wait, no, the law says this. That's been the status quo, and that has not worked. We haven't been able to do anything. And that's what brought our board together to say, we've got to broaden our view. We've got to do something different. Over the period of those 2.5 years, we worked with Congress, many experts, and a host of folks from the agency to try to put together what evolved into the ONC Trust Conservation and Jobs Act. That is a piece of legislation that recently passed the House of Representatives and now is in Senator Wyden's committee within a larger bill, the Hastings bill, which is a forest management bill, for consideration in the United States Senate. We don't have time to go through it in any detail at all. It is on the website, and there are a variety of ways to access it, and I would encourage you to do that. It's a fairly lengthy bill. Let me just mention very, very quickly some of the high points of what it does. First of all, it recognizes the issue of old growth. The ONC lands contain about 1 million acres of timber stands that are 125 years and older, the old growth. The ONC Trust Conservation Jobs Act protects permanently that 1 million acres of old growth, never to be used for commercial logging, and managed not under the BLM but under the Forest Service. In addition to that, we add almost 60,000 acres to the Wild Rogue Wilderness. We create a brand new wilderness area in Douglas County, the Devil's Staircase, 38,000 acres. We increase the designation of wild and scenic rivers by 130 miles and increase the riparian buffers around fish-bearing and non-fish-bearing streams. The remaining million-plus acres of the younger timber would be managed not under federal authority, but under an enhanced Oregon Forest Practices Act by a board of trustees appointed by the governor. And those lands would be managed for timber production as is prescribed in the ONC Act under the principles of sustained yield. Let me conclude, because Kathy has a very compelling set of remarks as well. We recognize and we have made it very clear that while we have worked hard with our counterparts throughout the county, the counties, and certainly our congressional delegation, that the ONC Trust Conservation Jobs Act is the best way we could see our way through to accomplish three things. One, a sustainable and predictable flow of raw material for the wood products industry, a predictable flow of revenue to the counties, and meaningful gains in the conservation community. But we are not wed to the trust idea. We are not wed to the ONC Trust Conservation and Jobs Act. What we are wed to are predictable, sustainable outcomes and sufficiency and certainty that those outcomes will be achieved on a sustainable basis. In other words, we need to get out of the court system. We have been mired in rules, restrictions, regulations, and requirements that have provided a labyrinth of laws that simply prevent these lands from being managed for their stated purposes. That needs to change. Finally, I just want to emphasize that many people, understandably, view federal timberlands as federal timberlands. They're all the same. The ONC lands are very unique. Although they are the Oregon-California revested grant lands, there aren't any in California. There aren't any in Washington. There aren't any anywhere else. They are only in western Oregon, with the exception of some in Klamath County. They are not national forests. They are not like the Mount Hood or the Willamette or the Umpqua or the Rogue Siskiyou. They are not managed by the Forest Service. They're managed by the Bureau of Land Management. They're not managed under the National Forest Management Act, which is a multiple use act. They are managed under the ONC Act, which is a dominant use act. And that dominant use is the production of timber. So they're very different, very unique historically, legally, and obviously physically. They are not large contiguous blocks of forest land. They are a checkerboard of sections, quarter sections, and half sections going through the upper Willamette Valley all the way down to the Rogue Valley. They're interspersed. They've been heavily managed. They're interspersed with industrial forest land owners, heavily roaded. And again, very different than national forests, and that distinction is very important. Well, hopefully we'll have a chance for some dialogue after the presentation. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you. Kathy.
Well, I can't follow that. That is the best explanation of the ONC lands I've ever heard, and we've been discussing this for a few years now, monthly in our board meetings, and Doug, you nailed it. The worst thing that I can see that happens in a group of people like this, with this much phenomenal information coming at you, is that you don't remember it. If you remember two things out of what he told you is that the ONC lands are not Forest Service lands. They are not federal lands. They are by who manages them, BLM, but they were meant to go to produce timber for this state, for the people in this state, so that the counties received revenues from this land that would benefit this state and the communities that are contiguous to this land. What makes you think of this? Why would you think of this? I can tell you this. As the environmental impact has affected Oregon over the last 20 years, closing down our U.S. forest lands, managed by the U.S. Forest Service, and BLM lands, this county, Lane County alone, has lost revenue on an average of $50 million a year. That went to schools, roads, anything that the county wanted to utilize that money for. That was from Forest Service lands. So the ONC lands that were mandated in 1937 to provide harvestable timber and the proceeds of that, 50% of that revenue, to go to those counties was to benefit our state. And that is the most important thing you can remember. Right now, across the board, we have Republican and Democrat federal legislators. Ron Wyden, Senator, Democrat. Jeff Merkley, Democrat, Senator. Peter DeFazio, Democrat, Congressman. Schrader and Walden are one Republican congressperson. Across the board, unilaterally agree that they have got to get our timberlands reopened in this state because this environmental impact unnecessarily closing down our forests by approximately 90% of our timber harvest has put a chokehold on this state and has left us without revenue, 14% unemployment, children not able to afford to buy school lunches, families out of work. And I'm going to give you a good example. Jennifer Philippi down in Rough and Ready Lumber Company in Cave Junction, small little enclave west of Roseburg and Grants Pass, actually. Fourth generation sawmill just closed the doors to Rough and Ready, a competitive mill, put 85 families in a mill-dependent town of Cave Junction out of work and said, it's like standing in the middle of a grocery store and starving to death. The timber resources in this state are the greatest natural forest resources, the most dense forests in the world. This has never been said, but from Roseburg to Portland, the density in the Cascades and the Coast Range is the most phenomenal anywhere in the world. So what you want to remember about the ONC, because you've come here to get some perspective on that and input on that, is we have every legislator in this state working to get the ONC lands opened up. And we have groups of people who are trying to fight that. I want to bring another point to you. The groups of people that are trying to fight that right now are headed by CEOs, not a concerned or a group of concerned citizens per se, but back in the federal government where this decision is taking place on our ONC lands here in Oregon, five major environmental groups, CEOs with over hundreds of millions of dollars worth of annual budgets, ask Ron Wyden to come into closed quarters to discuss and put pressure on him about what should happen to the ONC lands. So understand that it's a tax-free money. They are money-making entities at this point. And so if you look at what you want to, might perhaps want to call the timber industry and see it as a faceless industry, my father has been called the timber baron of Oregon. We have, my sisters and I have recently been touted as the new baronesses. I said, I'm going to go get a tiara. I've got to take advantage of this. I capitalize on it. A man who grew up on a farm barefoot herding cattle right here at the base of Mary's Peak, went to the University of Oregon and claims he was probably the poorest student there, cut out cardboard to put in his shoes during the winter to avoid wet socks, and worked his way through the University of Oregon, met my mother, and her father had a small planing mill here in Eugene. Her brother logged, and after trying to take my mother to Texas and sell real estate, she couldn't stand the heat, they came back and he got involved in the lumber business. He learned that business and since then has become one of the icons of this business because he loves nature, he loves the forest, he believes in what he does, and he loves his mill. And he has a mill on one site. We're not a Weyerhaeuser. We're not a George Pacific. We're not an IP. We're family created, born and bred. My sister Jody's right here. My other sister Becky, who's 2 years older than I am, couldn't be here today. But we are very, very proud to undertake and continue the legacy that my father has left to us because it was a lifetime of passion and hard work and risk-taking and believing in what he did to supply lumber to our community and the rest of this country as best he could. He said, don't get bigger, get better. He holds some of the top patents in the industry for some of the most refined milling equipment known in the world today. And in fact, he received a Lumberman of the World Award by a nomination of $50,000 from his peers. He didn't even know such award existed. They called him and said, Aaron, be prepared. You're probably going to get some questionnaires in the mail. He said, is that right? Well, I'm a busy man. What am I going to be answering questions about? They said, you. He ended up winning that award by vote of his peers and a group of judges. Most phenomenal thing. He was extremely moved, but he is not the biggest money maker. He is not the greatest producer of lumber, but he will tell you very proudly, I make the best lumber in this business. And that was his passion. It's his love. And Becky and Jody and I are happy to continue that standard of business. My father is Aaron Jones. Seneca Sawmill Company was started in 1954 by my father out on Highway 99, one wigwam burner, one small office building and a tin corrugated roofed hut that a sawyer pushed logs up and down a single saw as slabs of lumber fell off. My favorite part of that corrugated tin shack was the candy machine at the door. I was two years old when my father started Seneca, and he would take us out there very happily on weekends. My older sister is a total environmentalist. She's a lover of nature. She'd head out towards the pond and go find the ducks and the nests and everything else. This one right here would follow right after her and then disappear off and climb into one of the pieces of machinery that my father had taught us how to drive at a very young age. And I was usually in the paper room scribbling on new pieces of paper because I'm the writer mouth of the three of us. So I have heart and soul in my sisters, and I am the verbalizer. And what we decided to do several years ago was to put a face on a faceless industry. And that is why I'm here today speaking to you. In the past, we've had one of the most phenomenal legal minds and timber lumber experts in this country interfacing with the public, and for good reason, because this debate ends up and this controversy ends up in court. As Senator Ron Wyden said to me, Kathy, the Ninth Circuit Court is our biggest enemy. Why? Because right here in Oregon, the U.S. Forest Service will put up a timber sale, or the BLM. The environmentalists will come and contest that sale. It will go to our local courts in state. Our state will uphold the contract that the timber harvester purchaser has with the government agencies. And all they need to do is stick a stamp on a manila envelope, put an appeal in it, and send it down to the Ninth Circuit Court, and that sale is held up to 5 years. So we have been in court over this issue for 20 years. Our very brilliant in-house attorney, Dad was spending so much money having to go to court, he said, I might as well have my own attorney. So our very brilliant in-house attorney, Dale Riddle, has been interfacing for Seneca for a long time. And as my father began to regress out of the business, he is dealing with Alzheimer's, Dale stepped in and became that incredible voice and virtually the face of Seneca on the political and public front. What Becky and I and Jody realized was that as three women, we wanted to bring some heart back to this debate and this discussion. Why? Because we were raised with such a tremendous appreciation of nature. We were raised to love the forests, rivers, streams. We were raised on horseback and out camping. I spent many, many summers over in the Steens Mountains in the Little Blitzen Gorge, riding horses and eating off from a campfire and washing my clothes in the Little Blitzen River. My father founded the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. He's an avid hunter. My mother was one of the most phenomenal lovers of the wilds and the wilderness. She grew up barefoot out in Triangle Lake area, poaching deer and picking wild strawberries with her older brother. These were people who loved nature. They never believed they were separate from nature. They were one with nature. They believed in the harvesting of timber in order to create lumber. And they never were ashamed of that fact nor thought badly of it. They were creating a product that was needed in this country to build, and we still do need that product. It's a renewable resource. It's the most inexpensive and perfect product that you can use to build, and we still are proud of that. What's happened in Oregon is we've lost that sense of pride. We've been guilt-tripped, we've been falsely accused, and we've been told that we are the enemy of the land. You can't separate man from the land. It's an insanity. We are a part of the land by our very nature and by our very construct. We have to eat. But we have become Albertsonized, as I have said so many times now. This is my favorite word. Because we don't realize when we go in and buy those all that food off the grocery store shelves that somebody had to raise and then harvest those things. It's the same with timber. So the ONC is the object today, but I would like to say that there are several misperceptions that should be cleared up. When I have the opportunity like this, and I applaud you for asking for people to come and speak to you and give you information, when it's just a sign of intelligence, and we wish the people of Oregon would do this and raise their heads out of their daily lives and say, hey, what's really going on out there? Because there's been a lot of misinformation. And we have been remiss as industry people to stand up and express and educate and inform what really is going on out there. So first big misperception I want to speak about, and I hope you remember this, that we are out cutting old growth. Knee-jerk response, DNA, it's right in our DNA. Nobody wants to think big cathedral forests, beautiful big old growth trees are being just bulldozed for the greed and ignorance of an industry. My father never believed he was an industry. He was a man with a dream and a vision, and he was going to produce lumber, and he was going to do that as efficiently as he possibly could with a great passion for the forests and the lands. So no industry here. As I said, we're not warehousers, GPs, IPs, and big corporate structures. We are an independent company. We are family owned, and we love nature. So are we out cutting old growth? I want to put this to rest. The average, 95% of the mills in this state are cutting second growth timber. I want you to remember this, and I want you to hear this, because this is timberland that has been harvested before. So our average tree size that we harvest is 40 to 60 years old. By definition, old growth is 250 years and older. They're trying to bring that figure down into what Doug reported to you was the 125-year-old tree. That's a tree you can put your arms around. What's your identity when you think of old growth? Cathedral forests. I think of three men having to reach around a tree. We have it all over this state, by the way. Right now, our statistics are showing from satellite photography and U.S. Forest Service maps combined that we have over 1.2 million acres of trees 30 inches and greater on the stump. 1.2 million acres, and that's in 5 million acres in this state of large and giant trees. 5 million acres. That's over 7,000 square miles. It is all along the McKenzie Corridor up the rivers. It's all along our Siuslaw, Umpqua, and Rogue. It's all along our watersheds in both the Cascades and the Coast Range. So don't think we don't have old growth trees. We do. And where we are predominantly harvesting trees is in second growth forests. So if you think 40 to 60 year old harvesting, yes. And what do? When we harvest those, because of the Oregon Forest Practices Act, we replant, and we are required to replant within 2 years of that harvesting. So into the ground goes 2 to 3 and up to 6 seedlings that are already in tree version for every tree harvested. Seneca, because of my father's genius, about 22 years ago, he realized what this environmental impact was going to mean to people who were milling timber and needed timber resources to continue doing that, to provide lumber to this country and this community. He'd better start buying private timberlands, and he did that. Arguably, Seneca owns some of the most beautiful timberlands in the Northwest. We have 80% more wood fiber on our timberlands than when we bought them 20 years ago. So if your concern is, gee, they're just going to go out and just rape the forest, devastate it, and cut all this old growth, and we're not going to have any trees left, think again. It's like saying a cattle rancher likes to kill cows. No, cattle rancher likes to raise cows, but he likes to eat. So practicality, common sense will tell you that our forests have been harvested for over 100 years. They are still there, and this is a little known and expressed fact. There are more trees in our national forests and on our private timber lands in this state right now than there were 60 years ago, 20 years ago, even 100 years ago. More trees. More trees. So I'm going to end this now and go ahead and open this up. The misperception of old growth, I hope we can put that to rest. The mills in this state are not cutting old growth. Their milling equipment will not even handle old growth trees. So there are probably four mills that I know of right now who will take those large of trees. Is that a possibility? Yes. And if you talk to silviculturists, they will agree with that. So if that's the one thing you remember, besides the fact that the ONC lands were designated to provide for this state as timber harvestable land, you will have walked away from here with some good information. And thank you so much for having us here. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you to Kathy Jones and Doug Robertson. Now it's time to compose your questions as a table or individually. We'll take about a 5-minute break for you to do that. Please remember that anyone may help compose a question, but only City Club members may ask a question. And when you have a question ready, please come up and take a seat here so we can know that we're ready to resume the program. Thank you.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7 FM, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also on the web at klcc.org.
You're listening to Kathy Jones and Doug Robertson at the November 15th meeting of the City Club of Eugene. Now it's time for your questions on the topic of managing the ONC forest lands, an industry and county perspective. And we have John back to introduce our first questioner.
So our first questioner is Mary Grace Brogdon from Cascadia Forest Defenders. Mary Grace.
Thank you, John. Thanks for letting me come today. And I just want to say it's lovely that we could have both of you on the same program with industry and the county together. It's a lovely illustration of how she who pays the piper calls the tune. There was one piece of the tune missing about, well, there are a couple things missing in the tune, as Doug reiterated it, of the ONC law that passed in 1937. And the biggest theme, I think, here is that the federal government unintentionally coupled the fate of the counties in Western Oregon with the will of a single industry by making the counties dependent on income.
Mary Grace, do you have a question for us?
Oh, I sure do. But
thank
it's not
you.
It's not even about your family, although I feel like I'm so educated now. So because of the coupling of counties with federal money, you know, it was easy to become dependent, especially in the 1980s when we had, you know, 1.1 billion board feet of timber coming off those lands every year. Mm-hmm. At that point, we were logging 2 square miles of old growth a week in Oregon. We couldn't do that for a year now. And you would think that given the fact that the Northwest Forest Plan changed so many things in the 1990s, that the counties would have found a different way of doing business. But instead, they've had 4 federal bailouts and haven't come up with any new suggestions, as far as I know. In 1999, instead of changing the way we did things, we...
Is there a question?
There sure is. In 1999, House Bill 3575 made an exception for timberland owners owning more than 5,000 acres. That included corporations, so that those companies and individuals don't pay the tax that everyone else would pay on those lands and on the timber coming off of them. In 2007, a legislative review estimated that the state was losing $70 million a year because of this tax exception. My question is this. Why not, as a public servant, take a stand for the people of Oregon, for clean air, for clean water, for fish and wildlife, and for the future of our children in this state, that changes the law in a way that decouples our future from the timber industry. Why not ask wealthy timber families and corporations to pay their fair share of taxes? Why not?
Well, first of all, the severance tax was created after the Depression. Severance tax seems to come up in this question because, and the environmentalists like to say, why don't you pay a severance tax? Severance tax appeared to be a very large sum of money because it was posed to the landowner when the crop was able to be harvested. If a crop couldn't be harvested for 6 years, 8 years, 40 years, what they would normally pay yearly in property tax would be paid at the time that they could harvest their crop in order to pay that tax. So severance tax appeared to be a very large sum of money. This doesn't happen any longer because we pay annually. The timber owners pay property tax, and they also pay income tax on the value of the timber when it's sold. And it is absolutely the same as farmers, as tree growers. Anyone that's harvesting a crop pays in this way. And it always astounds me that the people who want to tax an industry to death also want to put that industry out of business. I would think if you wanted more money from the timber industry, you would be the greatest supporters of the timber industry.
So I have a question that emerges out of John's programs, which run three in a row, so you actually end up with an accumulated body of knowledge that doesn't quite add all up yet. So our question is about the difference between something we learned in the first program, I think it was called retention harvesting or regeneration harvesting, and it looked like instead of clear-cutting, these scientists were recommending leaving something like a third of the trees up to create some regenerative zones for biodiversity. And that was in contrast to, and that with chunks, not thinning. It wasn't thinning. It was like chunks of trees, bunches, and then all the rest of it looked clear-cut. Then this is opposed to clear-cutting, in which you take down every tree and clean out all the mess and then plant trees again. And I lived in Triangle Lake area for a long time, so we saw that happening all the time. And the scientists said, well, on one hand, you've got biodiversity happening, and eventually it all turns back into woods if you manage it right. And on the other hand, clear-cutting involves cutting everything out, cleaning it all up, and putting chemicals on it so that nothing else would grow except the trees. And so we wondered, like, to what extent is anybody doing the latter, clear-cutting, in Seneca in particular, since you know about that one? Or are you guys thinking that that's a good idea, the regeneration harvesting or retention harvesting?
First of all, I'm going to let Doug talk about this as far as the ONC is concerned and the difference between partial cuts and clear cut and how that's impacted by the Oregon Forest Practices Act and why that's done. And I'll be happy to answer it as far as Seneca's concerned.
What he said was that private companies tended to clear cut and do it, you know, just clean it all out and plant again. Whereas this other thing might work better on the collectively owned lands, public, federal.
The other thing I think you're referring to is the Franklin Johnson ecological forestry or regeneration forestry. And it is, we're not sure exactly what it is. We have seen some pilot programs that Franklin and Johnson have put forward. They have met with some interest, also some protest. Clear cutting is a tool, as is thinning, as is shelterwood cutting, and a useful tool in the management of a timber landscape, and a necessary tool. The Franklin Johnson approach is one that is being considered, and as I said, applied in a series of models and experiments, really, and it's unknown how that that's going to work. There are some, and there have been some articles written describing some of the problems with ecological forestry that we have more information on if you'd be interested.
Thank you. Janet Calvert, City Club member. There's been lots of science developed and understanding since the ONC Act, and there have been a couple proposals, DeFazio's and others, on how to solve this problem between cutting and environmentalism. So I'm wondering if you can address how these two bill, how the various approaches might take into consideration and reach some kind of compromise, balancing the need for clean water, protection of wildlife, humans, providing timber and the revenue to sustain communities, and see how can these measures achieve this kind of balance. And I'd like both of you to comment, if you possible.
I will tell you, this man worked for months, as did Dale Riddle, our attorney from Seneca, who was called by Peter DeFazio and Greg Walden to help give their expertise on that very question. And I will tell you, if we could answer that for you right now, we'd be famous. we'd have it made. We could just go back to Washington, D.C. and tell Obama what he should be signing. After months and months and months of work with a tremendous number of people, very educated people, people that were not in the industry, that had nothing to gain financially from what happened on those lands, but were very involved as silviculturists for the benefit of the forest, as well as environmentally concerned people, they finally created the DeFazio bill for the ONC lands to exactly to answer your very questions and concerns. And after it had passed Congress and all of this effort has been made, we have heard from Obama's administration that they would veto that bill if it came to President Obama. So the question you ask is incredibly important, and there's a lot of people trying to answer it.
Let me just mention a couple of things that do exist within the legislation that addresses some of your issues. One of the concerns with the ONC lands, as I mentioned, it is a checkerboard of alternative sections of private, public, private, public. One of the concerns, and you'll hear John Kober from Pacific Rivers mention this, is that the high-value watersheds for anadromous fish, for instance, it's very difficult to manage a watershed that goes through private land, public land, private land, with different requirements and subscriptions on how they're to be managed. In the ONC Trust Conservation Jobs Act, there is a provision that allows and promotes exchanges and trades to block up that checkerboard and protect those high-value watersheds. That doesn't exist today. In addition to that, 5% of the revenues that are generated from the sale of timber would be put in a conservation fund strictly to be used for environmental improvement throughout the state. So there are, among the other conservation gains that I mentioned, there are some other things that actually came out of the governor's panel when we met with the environmental community and the counties and some other folks. So there are some things that go in that direction.
Thanks, Commissioner. Edward McLone, City Club member since today, which apparently means I get the duty of asking my table's question. Thank you both for being here. The question coming from our table is, as we wait for federal action on the federal timberlands, what can be done to help the communities that are hardly, you know, impacted so much transition and diversify their economies to avoid the hardship?
Well, it's a very difficult piece of business. We live where we live. We can't change our geography. We live among some of the most productive, valuable, low-elevation timberlands in the world, and we're watching them burn up. We're watching them, because of the lack of management, become subjected to disease, insect infestation. They need to be managed, and they need to be managed in a balanced way that takes all considerations into account. That's what we've tried to do. The ONC Trust Conservation Jobs Act is an imperfect solution. We know that. There isn't a perfect solution, but it is an attempt to address all stakeholders with something substantive, something they can look at and say, this is a significant gain, whether it be a sustainable flow of raw material, something for the counties in the way of revenue, conservation community gains. That was the effort, and we hope it succeeds.
When you ask what can be done now, I think the most detrimental thing that's being done, even though I know Senator Wyden is doing his best to supplement the counties with federal aid, is this continual federal subsidies to our counties. We've had across-the-board county commissioners and legislators say, we want this stopped. We do not want to be federal funded dependent counties. This state has the ability to be absolutely self-sufficient. And so to continue in the mentality of saying, we'll take the federal handouts, we'll take these Band-Aid approaches, has literally been turned down by legislators all over this state, representatives all over this state, and Senator Wyden has heard that loud and clear. So hopefully there is not going to be a lot of help to the counties that are suffering until this ONC legislation is passed, and hopefully passed. And it's going to be a hard road, because there's some time to go yet.
Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Matthews. I first became a City Club member many years ago. It's great to be here talking about the future of Lane County in Western Oregon that we all care about very much. Living in East Lane County these days, thinking about high-value watersheds and which ones we would block up and protect, I think about the Mohawk Valley and the Mackenzie and the Middle Fork of the Willamette and the Coast Fork of the Willamette, the Umpqua over the ridge into Douglas County, and I wonder which of those watersheds the residents would not think of as a high-value watershed to protect. But my specific question is a follow-up on an earlier question to be a little more precise. Doug, in particular, you deal with this all over the state and in Washington, D.C. How do the severance taxes paid by industrial timber in Oregon today compare to the severance taxes paid in Washington and California? Thank you.
Kevin, the simple answer is I don't know. I don't know what the severance taxes are in those states. I'll get that information and respond as best I can.
I'm Vincenza Scarpacci, member of the City Club, and I want to suggest that the Fazio plan is not necessarily the be-all and end-all, even though it's been qualified by Wyden, et cetera, that maybe what we need to do is to get a coalition of private forest owners, companies, counties, and the federal state lands, because what we have now is a checkerboard situation of ownership. There is no natural corridors for wildlife, and I understand California has developed this system. And then also with the DeFazio plan, the administration of the lands will be under the Oregon's Forest Practice Act, which I've been told is a very restricted, not adequate program that does not measure up to Washington or California. So maybe what we need to do is to rethink this with the state, BLM, National Forest, industry, environmentalists. Maybe it needs another look again. And so should we draw a new battle line, or I should say more a new cooperation line?
Well, I'm searching for the question, but I think the reality is that You mentioned, and I would simply mention, the DNR lands in the state of Washington, which are managed at a higher level relative to watershed protection than some of the Oregon Forest Practice Act provisions. Actually, the DNR prescriptions have been adopted in the DeFazio bill. So we have tried to respond to some of those issues relative to the conservation community concerns.
Well, thank you. We're out of time. But thank you to Kathy Jones and Doug Robertson for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club discussion of managing the ONC forest lands, an industry and county perspective.
Thank you. We're off.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Helios Resource Network, 91.9 KRVM, and Marilyn Milne, Public Relations Services. Next week we will meet on November 22nd at the Eugene Hilton for new revenue for the city to meet the challenge or not. See you then.